Welcome to Interpreter Insights. Martin Tanner and Terry Hutchison, your hosts. Today, our topic is insights into the book of Genesis with our wonderful guest, Jeffrey Bradshaw. The mission of the Interpreter Foundation is to support the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints through scholarship. We make the latest and best scholarship available to you in podcasts, journal articles, book seminars, film symposia, roundtables, and now Interpreter Insights. We invite you to see what Interpreter has to offer at interpreterfoundation.org. If you like this podcast, please tell your friends about it and give us a 5-star rating. And we have one other piece of information we hope you're interested in. If you're looking for an amazing trip this summer, if you're looking for a marvelous family experience or one-of-a-kind gift, join the Interpreter Foundation for a meticulously crafted tour of Great Britain led by Dan Peterson and Chris Fredrickson. Explore storied LDS history sites. Learn about missionaries who sacrificed to preach the gospel in the UK and about those who converted to the church as a result of their efforts. Explore renowned cathedrals, palaces, and quaint villages. You'll see and participate in wonderful local events and conclude with 4 memorable days in London, one of the most exciting and great cities in the world. Space is limited, so book your reservations now by visiting Bountiful Travel at bountifultravel.com. Or call 801-453-9444. Again, that's bountifultravel.com or 801-453-9444. Now, insights into the book of Genesis with Jeffrey Bradshaw. It's such a pleasure to have you here, Jeff. Thanks for being with us.
Great to be here with you.
You have spent decades and decades on the book of Genesis. That is, of course, the reason why we have you here today. Talk a little bit about some of the basic points about the book of Genesis that people may not understand, where the word comes from, what the purpose is, in your opinion, about the writers of Genesis, that it's not just a scientific manual of how the world was created. What was the purpose for the book of Genesis? Why don't we start there?
Okay. My interest in Genesis actually goes back further than you know, because even as a boy, that used to be my go-to book of scripture. And I think I liked it because I could relate to the people. I had some beautiful biographies, people who were presented in all their glory and all their difficulties. And I just felt so close to God when I was reading it. So that was the Genesis for me. But as I've gone forward, yeah, it's a multifaceted book because it touches on so many things, beautiful art, beautiful music, beautiful, doctrine, foundational. Joseph Smith recognized that because in the Joseph Smith translation, he took more than a quarter of his time for that 1% of the book from Genesis 1 to 24. Than he took for the 75% of the other 99%. So that tells you something about the importance for the prophet. The word Genesis, of course, comes from beginning, and like many of the books in the Pentateuch, the first books of the Bible, it's really, a Greek word representing the first words in the Latin text, which is, of course, I mean, in the Hebrew text, which is, of course, in the beginning. And its scientific aspects also have been intriguing for me. I like, I'm sure many of our listeners have wondered about, how did creation occur? How did what's the deal about the flood and the Tower of Babel? What about the destruction of Sodom, for that matter, and these miraculous events? Fortunately, I never had a faith problem with those things because I've been blessed with really a strong testimony that church and that God can do anything he wants. And I've seen it firsthand, even as recently as this week, as we'll talk about. Those kind of things can happen. However, it's an easy answer to just say God waved his hand and it happened. And it's more interesting and enriching to me to see how the stories of Genesis come together with science in interesting ways, and how we can appreciate it better almost when we understand it as a literary and a spiritual work and a temple-saturated book rather than just a handbook of how the world was created and got to be here.
Jeff, it's interesting that you bring up how you got interested in Genesis because a couple of years ago, when Ron Handel released his Anchor Bible Genesis volume, we were able to interview him with Interpreter. Sadly, due to a technical problem, that interview is not posted on the website and it's lost, unfortunately. But one of the things he distinctly mentioned was his interest in Genesis began with the story of the Watchers. And that's something you cover in your second IGE in God's Likeness and Image volume, in particular, that with how it intersects with the story of Enoch and the ta then eventually leads us to the Tower of Babel, as you were just mentioning. But I think anybody who comes to Genesis, there's something there for nearly everybody. And I wonder why that is.
Are you asking me why that is? I
Well,
don't
why not?
know.
Why don't you know? I mean, I think personally, and maybe you would agree that, as you were saying, the biographies there are so rich that even you, as a young man and as a maybe even a boy, recognized the fullness of these people who were real people to you because of the way they were portrayed, in their fullness, if you will, the strengths, the weaknesses, all of the human nature. And I think even people as secular or scholarly, they find themselves or they find something interesting to follow in Genesis. And maybe it's because that's our common origin.
I agree with what you're saying, and sort of to the theme of finding yourselves. One of my favorite lines, and it's just because it's very personal, in C.S. Lewis's the sort of dramatic depiction of his courtship called Shadowlands, which has been made into a movie with Anthony Hopkins and others, where he talks to a troubled student whose habit was stealing books. And he mentioned something his father said that just resonated to me first time I heard it. He said, "I read to know that I'm not alone." And I guess that was what struck me in terms of finding myself there, as you say, what does it appeal to other readers? I have no idea, because I'm kind of an odd duck when it comes to my interests and passions in life and my professional life as well as my spiritual life. But there I said, these people know more about my spiritual life and the things I've experienced even as a young man than anyone I know living. And all of a sudden I discovered people that I could relate to. And that's true, of course, for the other scriptures, in particular the Book of Mormon and Joseph Smith. But I first discovered that in the Bible, and I said, I'm not alone. I'm not crazy. People had experiences that are very similar to my own at a spiritual level.
Perhaps the greatest mystery of all is existence. Anybody who's a thinking person wonders, how did this all come about? And that's the great question that the book of Genesis answers. It answers where things came from. Before we went on today, we were talking a little bit about the difference between how literal Latter-day Saints see Genesis and how far less literal most other religious persuasions do. And maybe talk about that for a minute or two. And one of the things I'd like you to address in that is that the early people, as recognized in several different passages in the Bible, they took Genesis to be fairly literal. And they talked about the location of the Garden of Eden and gave different geographical ways that you could find it, which of course we can't used very well today because a few of the rivers are missing or misnamed. But I don't know how far you want to get into that, but we see it literally, or at least quite literally, and that's an important thing.
Yeah. I'll just say that Joseph Smith had it right to focus on the book of Genesis, like Hugh Nibley used to say, with everything going against him and nothing going for him, how could he lose, right? And that is exactly how I feel in a way. He, I think, not only realized that, and this is a strength of our faith, that we are allied with science, and with very few exceptions, the church has never had a quibble about an old earth going clear back to Brigham Young. In fact, there's some quotes from Brigham Young himself. He fluctuated in his opinion somewhat because it was opinions. We didn't have doctrines on it. But there are passages that he's spoken that even say that he was thinking seriously about how all creatures link back to a common tree of life. And that's one thing we have going for us is that the emphasis, the glory of God is intelligence, the emphasis on learning from the very beginning of the Restoration, I think, is a plus for us. And then secondly, I think another thing Joseph Smith and his successors have going for us is the fact that the Book of Genesis in particular was recognized as something that was strongly connected with the temple. And not just the temple as we know it in the Old Testament, but in the restored temple, which was, as we believe, the original temple of Solomon, something close to it. And so when we look at the story of creation, let's take as an example how it is, to take it most literally, it's a literal. The Garden of Eden is a literal reproduction of the heavenly temple more than it is a reproduction of the foliage and animals on earth. In fact, the Islamic accounts of the story about Adam naming the animals and some of the other early traditions about that see Adam as giving names to a succession of angels to show his worthiness to be God's representative on earth. And that'll ring a bell for Latter-day Saints. It was not all about naming the animals. So, in a sense, the Hebrew text lost something in translation because the most literal form was we're now on earth seeing an opportunity to recreate a copy of the heavenly temple. Does that make any sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you for sharing that insight. One of the things that is apparent, and Brigham Young brought this out in one of his public addresses, that not all of the Book of Genesis is literal. And he made a comment about Adam's rib being used to create Eve. There's obviously symbolism in there. Brigham Young certainly didn't think that Eve was created from Adam's literal rib. So how would you approach, or how would you suggest that people approach stories like that? What are they to be, what is there to be learned from the story of the creation of Eve, for example, and some of the things that seem to be much more symbolic than literal?
I'll just say it's the what can be learned about those subjects, and I guess I'm at least a proof text about that, is inexhaustible. It's kind of like Elijah's cruse of oil and inexhaustible bread. You can keep going and going. But I have to say, the more you read other scriptures, modern revelation as well as the Bible, the more you understand about Genesis, and the more you read, more you understand the temple, the more you understand about Genesis, not just about Adam and Eve, but about the whole plan of salvation and replicating time after time. When I say replicating, in a sense, without going into detail, I've argued that Noah's experience of a fall in essence of the earth and a recreation of the earth from the waters and his little ark that repopulated the earth is a replay of the Adam and Eve story, as are stories throughout the Old Testament and throughout Genesis. And also, I'd say, not only knowing the Bible and the scriptures and knowing the temple, but also realizing that the Genesis doesn't stand alone in its stories. And Gary Rendsburg has been a great eye-opener for me. But the stories of Genesis, as they were perhaps recouched in the later period of time, obviously the stories themselves are very old and very sacred and have an origin as old as Adam. But they deliberately, the inspired authors, brought out resonances, especially with things having to do with First and Second Samuel, the story of David and the monarchy, the story of the kings and Exodus, all through it. So the more you recognize those connections throughout the entire Old Testament, not to mention how Jesus spoke of Genesis and themes in Genesis, you're going to be enriched, and I hope as delighted as I am every time I dive into it.
Yeah, the Genesis story, and then the flood of Noah and the rebirth again. That's sort of the quintessential examples of one eternal round. You have this something that repeats itself over and over again. Since the church has just talked about how members are now encouraged to use different translations of the Bible to enhance their study. We're not supposed to get rid of the King James Version, but the church is encouraging use of other translations. Do you have any versions of the Old Testament in particular that you particularly like in addition to the King James?
Let me comment first of all on your general point. It is interesting that the brethren, because this is something I've been thinking about a lot. One of these days, I'm going to write an article about the new Bible versions. They didn't just recommend other translations in general, they gave ones that are somewhat rooted in the King James Version, but have an updated vocabulary. And so
Yes.
that's where, at least at the level of vocabulary, we have trouble. You know, it talks about have a goodly conversation in the New Testament, and all of a sudden we think we're talking using it to in a talk to talk about using pure and holy language. And what conversation really meant was good behavior. And so there are all kinds of words like that. I should have used an Old Testament example. But I think the resonance with the King James Version in Genesis in particular is useful in this way. It repeats key terms with the same word. And so if you read the King James Version, you get a sense of the underlying Hebrew that you wouldn't get in reading some modern translations where they feel compelled to vary the word. And that repetition ties different pieces together, like we see in chiasmus in other ways. The other thing is, it ties us to the other books of modern scripture, because they are using King James style language for whatever reason the Lord chose to have it translated that way. And so when we read a passage in the Book of Mormon or in the Doctrine and Covenants, we notice the similarities and differences. So what can that said, I love I will I'll just say one other thing about King James Version. Its style for the Old Testament is perfect because it's a plain, somewhat dignified style, which is the Old Testament Hebrew. Now, for the New Testament, I could be argued out of that because that was a much more colloquial, everyday talk thing. And sometimes reading the New Testament King James doesn't capture the spirit of it. But for a Genesis, it's great. What do I enjoy? I enjoy some of the insights provided by Ronald Hendel, who you've interviewed before, and his commentary. Robert Alter, of course, has done a beautiful job at thinking about some of the verses, but not always the best version. Gordon Wenham, Victor Hamilton have been some other commentators and translators I've really enjoyed. Wenham, in particular, is very good at picking out chiasms that I had missed for years. And then I like some of the literal translations, like Everett Fox's, and yeah, because that enables somebody who's not a Hebrew speaker to get at a little closer to the Hebrew. So those are just some of the ones that are my go-to translations. Although I have to say, once I understand what the King James is trying to say and get over the vocabulary problem, I almost prefer, I'm just
I do too.
I prefer.
I'm married to it almost. It's the beautiful of the English, beauty of the English that they use is incredible. And I don't, it has yet to be surpassed.
But that said, not everybody reads Shakespearean, early
For
English,
sure.
and not everybody has access or interest in having to go to or ability to go to the other works. So I'm both hands sustaining what the church has done there. Did
Great.
that answer your question? Did that
Yes,
agree?
that's wonderful. Thank you. So as we dive into the book of Genesis itself and talk about its background, as a re as I'll ask it this way, are we supposed to learn something about the actual origins of humanity from the story of Adam and Eve, or are we simply supposed to learn that God was in charge of all of the creation and don't worry about it? In other words, give us a few more of your insights into what, as Latter-day Saints, we're supposed to take from the creation, the earliest parts of the book of Genesis.
Great question. So when you say learn about humanity, it depends what you're looking for. As you implied, that the book of Genesis, the early books of creation, and the stories of Adam and Eve, and even up through Enoch, teach us about the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, as we learn in the temple. So what our purpose is in here in life, we wouldn't know anything about those without revelation in scripture and from prophets. And so, in that sense, yes. But I think you're getting at a point: is it meant to be interpreted as a scientific treatise? And there, I'd say no. Because you see, because when you understand it for what it really is, as a book telling us about sacred and holy things related to the temple, then you say, of course, it's not telling us about the material creation. In fact, Joseph Smith used the word quite frequently. It's about the organization of the world, not the creation. He didn't wasn't much into creation ex nihilo from nothing, like many are. And he, and there are modern scholars, just are as are there are ones coming up with modern scholars, non-Latter-day Saints who have the temple interpretation, who agree and actually have used in many cases words that come close to organizing. It's like organizing a company. What we learn from that is God set up the world with a certain order, a priesthood order, and an order about becoming holy and moving towards Him. And He organized Adam and Eve as, let's just say, priest and priestess and king of sorts, to teach their children the pattern or the order to organize the world in the sense that God cares about it, which is as a Messiah people.
Thank you. Let me ask a more crisp question than I did. I because that was a little bit too broad. I but your answer was wonderful nonetheless. Thank you for your comments. I know a few people who have left the church, some young people, some older people, when they read through Genesis and it dawned on them, wait a minute, I'm not sure I believe that the earth was created before, the sun, moon, and the stars or something. In other words, they look at the order of creation and say, well, that can't be right. And this is not meant to be a scientific manual. This is meant to be a description of how God didn't just create, but he created in a very important way. And I see the order of creation as that's mentioned is more akin to the importance of the things that were created, and as you mentioned, the temple and the cosmological order of things, not just the order of things here on Earth. So perhaps with that comment, make some further
Yeah,
statements.
you said it very well. Maybe I should say frankly that I've hard since I was old enough to read books, and especially Hugh Nibley was a big influence on me, as well as scientific books. I've not believed that the Earth was very young, a few thousand years old, and I have no problem. In fact, it strengthens my case to study the origin of the universe and discover it's billions of years old, and that it's been organized from pre-existing, what should I say, from a universe that isn't that is frequently recreating itself. In terms of the evolution question, I'll just say up front, I can't find any better explanation for the creation of man than through something like organic evolution, obviously set in motion and guided by the Lord in his wisdom. And so I have no problem with that. And
Right.
many of the leaders of the church have been very strong in leaving that door open. And the flood, let's just mention that one. That and Hugh Nibley was a great inspiration to me on that too, because he pointed out some scriptures that are very clear that when it's coming from talking about the earth being covered, it's the whole earth. It's really from Noah's point of view, and for it's very centered on the world in which he lives, and there's some clues in there that we won't have time to go into here that tell us that no, it didn't have to be covering every inch or even every continent of space to be the new creation that God wished it to be.
So you've written about that, Jeff, in your second volume of In God's Likeness and Image, but you also have a relationship with a scholar named Michael Morales. Tell us a little bit about that, because he gave a presentation in one of the first Matt Brown Temple conferences. Was that I haven't been able to look for that. Was that live, or was that just a paper he submitted? How did that relationship develop between you and him, and how much of an impact did that have on your work?
Michael Morales is a great man, a great Christian, and a great scholar. He and I first got to know each other when I became that he aware that he was writing on temple themes. In fact, he turned out to be another Margaret Barker that was citing and say, citing Latter-day Saint scholars and writing things that were very compatible with our view of things. In fact, he has an edited volume that includes, I think, two or three temple papers from Latter-day Saint scholars. We fortunately lived close enough to each other that when he was teaching in Florida at a theological university there, that we were able to visit a few days, and I was just thoroughly impressed. We've carried on that relationship. He gratefully advised me on that second volume of In God's Image and Likeness on the temple themes, because he was also convinced, as I was, that Noah's Ark was a proto-temple. That is to say, it foreshadowed the temple, and that the events foreshadowed and the symbols foreshadowed, some of the things that went on in both backwards into Adam and Eve and forward, whatever. His dissertation under Wenham was on that subject. Since that time, most recently, I've wanted to get him out to speak at some more conferences. He's just been so busy, and including busy with a family, that he hasn't. But he helped me on a recent chapter I did for the Joseph Smith A Life Lived in Crescendo book. I wanted to represent the different views of flavors of Calvinism that were afloat at Joseph Smith's time and contrast them with Joseph Smith's work. But I didn't want to do that without having a close friend read those through, and a knowledgeable friend, and correct me where I misunderstood things, because it's a very subtle topic that's divided some parts of the Christian world. And he very kindly offered some points of view on that. So hopefully, I'll just say the relationship's still intact, and hopefully we'll get him out to a conference again someday when his life settles down a little bit. He's just finished some two big commentaries on Numbers. He's done ones on Exodus and Leviticus. Magnificent man, magnificent Christian.
Two main areas I hope we can cover here in the next few minutes before we wrap things up. The first one is talk about the nature of God in Genesis. It seems to me that that's one of the books in the Bible that portrays God as a divine person, very much the way that Joseph Smith saw him in the first vision.
Yeah, that's a great thing. Yeah, we don't need to point to just to the first vision as our witness of that, because all through the five early books of the Bible, including the story of Moses, as you know, where Moses saw him face to face. Sorry, Abraham's on my mind for, so forgive me. But David Friedman, let's just say one of the foremost Latter-day Saint scholars, now unfortunately passed away, but the chief editor for the Anchor Bible series and many others, was very strong on this point. Not only that God was portrayed in Genesis and elsewhere, and particularly in the story of creation, as a divine man, and man was created literally in his image, but he was male, and that there was a female counterpart implied in the way God was portrayed in the Old Testament. There's a wonderful chapter I've quoted from it a lot in my In God's Image and Likeness one book about Adam and Eve, but you can also find the full work that he's done in a book by Truman Madsen, a Human Nature Symposium he did that's kind of hard to find that I would recommend. And you don't need to go to a Latter-day Saint scholar to find out that that is how God was viewed by early believers.
I think William Dever had one called "Did God Have a Wife?" Yes,
Yes.
that's another one
That
that
was,
a lot of people are familiar with.
yep. And another one on those in that direction is Raphael Patai, who had a book about
The
God
Hebrew
being a
goddess.
person and God having a wife, there being a female deity in ancient Judaism. So
So, Jeff, before we leave that topic, what about Gary Anderson's work, The Genesis of Perfection?
oh, I
Because he's
love
got a
him.
lot of good stuff in there.
Yeah. Gary Anderson is a great scholar, especially of Adam and Eve. He's not only translated many things in the Christian tradition, but also from very obscure traditions such as Armenia and elsewhere. One of the things that impresses me that I quote maybe perhaps too often is that he believes, as we do, that the book of Genesis isn't simply about a fall, it's about a fall forward. It's about the kernel that allows Adam and Eve to be brought to a place where they can begin to become perfect as God in heaven and our mother in heaven are perfect. So that he calls one of his a book I'll recommend that you've mentioned, Gary Anderson's The Genesis of Perfection. I'd recommend that to anyone because he understands the story of Adam and Eve and their successors is about mankind becoming like God and the fall being an enabling point for us there.
He has a very interesting take on how to read the scriptures, particularly the Old Testament, that he outlines in his new book, which is about the tabernacle and how it's the tabernacle itself, the tabernacle of Moses with its furnishings and other things that help us understand the incarnation of Jesus Christ. Now he writes, I think he's a professor at Notre Dame. He writes from the Catholic tradition, but still, it's a really interesting thing where he says you go back and you read it, and you don't read it to prove what you know from the New Testament. You read it to foreshadow and point to the New Testament so that you can better understand how this Old Testament and the Hebrew Bible leads us to Jesus Christ.
And I'll just add to that briefly because I know we're short on time, but that's the same way Christians and Latter-day Saints read and ought to read the story of Abraham's sacrifice of Isaac. And that is a very old tradition that goes back to Second Judaism, at least, in terms of reading that as a foreshadowing rather than just an event of God representing his love for corporate Israel. Or, as some modern scholars say, a way of saying once and for all, we're not about child sacrifice.
Well, we'll cover that a bit more in our second part for sure.
We absolutely will. It has been a pleasure to have you here. Before we end, I will mention that Jeff Bradshaw has published many, many articles in the Interpreter Foundation Journal about the Book of Genesis and related topics, which are highly, highly recommended. And his two volumes on Genesis, although somewhat hard to find, are amazing if you can get a hold of one. So.
The hard the they're both still for sale, and can be gotten through Amazon, and the one, of course, only in paperback now. But yeah,
Yeah.
thank you. Thank you. It's been a
Yeah.
delight of my life. Book of Moses, of course, is the translation of the first eight chapters of Genesis, which I didn't even realize till I got into it. Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Well, we'll cover more of this. We're going to interview Jeff in our next episode as well. So we hope everybody joins us for that. Thanks for being with us, Jeff.
Thank you,
Join us
Mark.
again on Interpreter Insights. I'm Martin Tanner with Terry Hutchison, saying bye for now.